Thanks. This is definitely the detection end of dark matter, and that's how I entered this, having spent much of my career building particle detectors. But generally accelerated. I should say I've done one dark matter search before in my life. I looked for magnetic monopoles in the early 80s. Because after all, magnetic monopole was observed in the early 80s, and for a while that was a favored form of dark matter. Boss Cabrera, who's part of this, this is the CDNS collaboration, including Boss Cabrera, who saw the original monopole in the 80s one. It came in the 70s for someone else. But then, we haven't seen it since it left Boss's apparatus. So this is the collaboration. The detectors have been developed primarily by Berkeley and Stanford. And Santa Barbara has generally built the low radio, the low activity room and shield and data acquisition systems and things like that. But for Santa Barbara, this whole activity is a descendant of double beta decay work that was done in the 80s that led to the first actual dark matter sensitivity. But I'll approach it from my own viewpoint because I just think of this somehow differently. Because I always think we're looking for some sort of new cosmic radiation. Cosmic rays, after all, were where a lot of elementary particles were discovered until the 1950s, and that's what we're doing again. We're looking for a new fundamental elementary particle and seeing if that's the dark matter. Sufficiently weakly interacting that they go through the Earth, that is, they interact like neutrinos. And I don't know why, when I think of this experiment, I always think of a thought experiment, or an experimental thought. I don't necessarily think of the motivation for this experiment. But this is an experiment that it was always in my mind, I don't know, when I was undergraduate. If you could use the Earth as a shield, so this is the Earth as a shield. You call it out a little cavity in the center of the Earth. And put some detector, which if it looks like a hockey puck, that's not a coincidence. Our detectors look like hockey pucks. You'd shield yourself from, the mostly proton-induced cosmic radiation that bombards us all the time and is gone pretty much when you go not that far into the Earth. If you could eliminate radioactivity, and that's a big if, okay? Turns out you really can. But if you could, and if you could cool that thing down to zero, essentially to absolute zero. I've always wondered what would happen, if at time equals zero, you cool it to absolute zero. And you isolate it from all known influences, what happens to it? Does it just stay at absolute zero? Okay. Or does it gradually warm up with some interesting rate of warming? And does it come to the 3-degree background, for example, through a mechanism that might be new? This is a sort of the experimental motivation. What we're actually doing resembles this a lot. Okay. Except the difference is, instead of measuring the temperature as a function of time, we essentially differentiate it. We look for impulses in temperature, energy deposited in this bit of matter. And then, if you're thinking of the temperature, the typical fluctuations of a 3-degree background are way small compared to the impulses that we're actually sensing. Looking for impulses that are about 10 to the ninth as big as KT at the cosmic microwave background temperature. So really big pulses. What kind of stuff could cause such huge pulses? By the way, that's about the size of the pulses that I'm talking about is KeV, kiloelectron volts, instead of microelectron volts is sort of the typical energy of the cosmic microwave background. Huge pulses. What could do that? Well, if there were heavy particles of order 100 GeV, that is on the electroweak scale, that didn't interact much, okay, and if they did happen to scatter on a nucleus in the detector, that's the kind of pulse that you do with the result. And so that's what we're really looking for. Now, why would you, here's my little bit of astrophysics, why would you ever think that kind of particle was interesting, a new entity in the cosmic radiation? Well, that's what's been covered in the last week or so here, I guess. Okay. Although, I guess this is a map of not particular galaxies, but all the galaxies that have been surveyed. That's from the National Academy's publication on this, I guess. Okay, and it looks like if you want to simulate that, you'd like to have some non-relativistic matter that's dark. Otherwise, the characteristic sizes might just get too big, for example, to use neutrinos. And the particular bet we're making is that the cold dark matter is actually massive particles. There are other bets. Could be very light particles, axions, sort of light pi zero. But we're placing our money that it's massive. And part of that is the following coincidence or clue. Stole another picture from the National Academy's stuff on the early universe. So here's the Big Bang over time. Starting from some incredibly small time, evolving through all the physics that we wish we had experimental data on, and then into the area when radiation is dominating the universe. And a problem is, if they're massive particles, they would be created in thermal equilibrium at some point, or via thermal processes, okay? And at some point, be in thermal equilibrium with the photons that are in the radiation-dominated area. But then as the heat bath cools to less than the mass of those particles, they drop out of equilibrium. If the ability of the massive particles to communicate with radiation is absent, you find that these massive particles would steal most of the energy of the universe as a good thing. There's got to be some way of communicating with radiation to see a balance like we see today. Well, really communicating with all forms of matter. That's just what keeps you in equilibrium with the radiation, but with other forms of matter to make a balance. And the cross-section really is at very low energies. It's an exothermic reaction, so the cross-section times the relative velocity of the two particles goes to has got to be approximately a bunch of constants that have nothing to do with experimental particle physics today, I should say. And are cosmological constants, effectively. Newton's constant of gravity, the temperature at which these things fell out of equilibrium, I guess, the Hubble constant, and then 1 over the current density of dark matter. And you evaluate this number, and surprisingly enough, it's about the same typical cross-section times relative velocity that the weak interactions would get. So this is either a coincidence or it's something, some really important hint that there's some deep connection between the weak interaction scale and the Big Bang. And so we're betting that it's not a coincidence, that there's really something important. Now, a little aside, for me anyway, is this is one of the clues that whatever the new mass scale is, it's around 100 GeV, that is the weak scale. And the speculation, which we hope is true in experimental particle physics, is something, the most popular thing now is SUSY. It's not the, dark matter is one of the good reasons we think that SUSY might be at the weak scale. There's also some evidence, not that convincing, but it's there, that from precision electroweak stuff right now, would tell us, yeah, that's right, the weak scale is about where SUSY is broken. The contradiction is we don't really see flavor-changing nuclear currents, which terribly constrain them. And this is the other stuff that at least I can group. It may be that the best bet to hide flavor-changing nuclear currents is to somehow make the supersymmetric partners of the heaviest sparks the lightest partner. That's the favorite thing right now. And maybe neutrino oscillations, something else we hear about that, are already indicating that. I don't know.
Can you say a little bit more about what the precision electroweak measurements are telling?
Precision M top and MW right now. Okay, and the loop corrections to that give you sensitivity to the logarithm or the logarithm of the mass of the Higgs. It looks like it's small right now. A small Higgs, how do you regulate its mass? You put some new physics just above it to keep its mass down.
But it would be a particle that would be matched
That's if it's SUSY, what's the dark matter connection? SUSY provides a plausible candidate for what the dark matter would be. Some linear superposition of the partner of a photon, the Higgs, and the C0. And exactly how the mixing works, well, that's too baroque for me to explain. okay. But, okay, some superposition of these particles, but I always just think the Volcano, but it could be in general a superposition. Okay, so this is a plausible candidate for what could be the dark matter, the heavy dark matter particle. And the last time I looked at the left two limits on such a particle, it was that it had to be greater than about 40 GeV. So above 40 GeV, terrestrial experiments aren't constrained right now. Obviously, this number is going to go up, you know, soon at the Fermi Lab and the LHC. Enough connections. The deal is, I probably didn't have to put this step, but if you have, if the thing is ever in thermal equilibrium, there's got to be a way that it can connect to quarks, that is our matter, and annihilate into our matter. But then you can take this Feynman graph and the profit, reverse these guys. The process that keeps dark matter from flooding the universe, that lets us have some matter and own our little tiny slice of the universe that we've got. Okay. You just cross that, and you conclude that the dark matter must interact with us. And that's the basis of the experiment. That's a pretty good bet to make. So that's the heart of the matter. The other thing about this dark matter, you know, okay, the Big Bang's one thing. Another thing is our own galaxy. Now here again, I'm venturing into stuff that I don't know that much about. But what always matters to me is not looking at some other galaxy's rotation curve, but the Milky Way's rotation curve. And if you plot as a function of distance from the center of our galaxy in kiloparsecs, we're at about 8 kiloparsecs, and the rotation speed around the center of just stuff in our own galaxy, it never declines. And so we think our own Milky Way galaxy has dark matter. So if you make a search on our Earth, look for dark matter, you have some hope. This curve tells you that you have hope of finding stuff around here. Now, I wish I had had more time to come in the last week or so, because one out, if we look for dark matter and don't find it, one out is to say, locally, we just don't have any dark matter. Maybe the dark matter is clumping. And I guess some of the evidence for that was presented at the meetings. I tried to come to a few, but I didn't hear that. I sure hope that it isn't so clumpy that our experiment would be interpreted as, locally, there doesn't seem to be much dark matter. That doesn't really say anything about the galaxy. Yeah, and it goes the other way, yeah. I agree. Okay, so this plot, which for me is important. If you do galactic physics, you know this number in your tattooed your eyelid, but about 200 kilometers per second is the typical speed of these guys. And that matters in the end for a bunch of stuff. Okay, so how do you detect these guys? There is some sort of dark matter particle coming at a nucleus in one of our detectors, and in our experiment, we use silicon and germanium primarily because you can purify these guys really well, and there's a long history of using them for nuclear experiments. The two most common isotopes are even total, and I think even. There's an interesting isotope of germanium. We haven't done anything yet, but we have a big block of germanium-73 where there's an unpaired nucleon and a net spin. And that's really helpful if you start asking over the dark matter actually has spin-dependent interactions. When we use that block, we get some. But none of our sensitivity right now comes from that. Okay. Additionally, the competitors who are seeing a signal in Italy use iodine, which has a substantially greater atomic number. And so. This guy going about 200 kilometers per second compared to the speed of light, about a part in 1,000. much slower than the speed of atomic electrons in material. So when one of these guys goes through matter, the electrons adiabatically reconfigure themselves. You don't deposit much energy on the electrons. Even if you did deposit much energy, it wouldn't be that much because one half m of an electron times that beta squared isn't much energy. And that's the opening point in why we look at the nucleus so much. An odd point, of course, is the nucleons in a nucleus themselves are going at near the speed of light. Okay, in the end, the cross-section for interaction doesn't depend at all, or doesn't depend much, on the relative velocity. So the fact that this is a swarm of bees going around at the speed of light doesn't make any difference. We just pretend that it's static and there's no... that's a good approximation. There's another important point of this that I'll just immediately say. A simple quantum mechanics problem. Mostly, what is the Broglie wavelength of that guy? And it's really, of the momentum transfer, but forget about that. Ultimately, the de Broglie wavelength of that guy is long compared to the size of the nucleus. And that means that the scattering amplitudes for all the different nucleons add coherently. And so you win in scattering cross-section not as A, but as A squared. And that pushes you. You really want to go to the heavier things if you can for that reason. So this is just a diagram of what the numbers are if you have a 100 joule weak scale wind. The effect of de Broglie wavelength for the monon transfer actually is about 20 fermis. And if you look at germanium here, the radius of the nucleus is about 5 fermis. And if you raise the mass of your WIMP up, eventually you start to get to a point where you get decoherent interactions. Okay, so you win as A squared. As to what kind of cross sections you expect, crossing the annihilation diagram, this calculation was done by Witten and Goldman a while ago, 1985 or so. And just to get you oriented to the orders of magnitude, for just one nucleon, if the cross section is 10 to the minus 40 centimeters squared, and that's a typical neutrino interaction cross section. And if the dark matter is whatever fraction of 10 to the minus 29th grams per centimeter squared, which is about the closure density, and if your velocity is in 200 kilometers per second, and that just determines rate, it's just a kinematic factor, about 0.06 events per day if you have a kilogram block. Okay. And so, about 20 days before you between signals if you just have 1 kilogram. So clearly, you wish you could get up to the tens or hundreds of kilograms. That's what you want to do. And in fact, the Dama collaboration is up here, the hundreds. For what we're doing, we're down near, actually we're sub 10 right now, we're sub 1 kilogram. And that's because we've been developing technology for a specific region. And you end up with a smaller detector when you're developing something new. Eventually, we'll get up to about 10. Then, there's just a little bit of more kinematics. This is not really, all that's going on is elastic scattering between these two guys. There's no tricks, it's just elastic scattering, but you're just in the wrong frame. And if you just would like to kinematically... You bet. Good question. That's a very good question. And, it's really simple kinematics. You just need to go to the right frame, to the center momentum frame, where the two, the nuclei and the WIMP, have the same momentum. There's the momentum there. And to do that, you've got to do a boost back in that direction. If the mass of the WIMP were infinity, you'd boost backwards by its velocity. Because then the WIMP would be infinitely massive, and you'd be in exactly the wrong frame. Reduced by V, and then there's reduced mass factor. Okay, and then in that frame, you've just got elastic scattering. And it's at least if it's spin independent, it's just isotropic. You boost back into the lab frame, and what it looks like is the nucleus just recoils. That is, the turning in the center momentum frame looks like the recoil in our frame. And it's easy enough to work out what the energy transferred, no, this is the square of the velocity. Okay, this is just the speed squared. Okay, and it's got this kinematic factor and then some angular factors where theta star is the center of mass scattering angle. Okay. It's just straightforward. The most energy you could ever get transferred is given then is proportional to the square of the relative speed, the mass of the isotope you're using, and some reduced mass factor. Okay. And so if you're looking for the signal, there's a couple handles you got. One is the relative speed. The maximum energy transfer depends on the square of the relative speed, and that's used by the Italians to look for their dark matter signal. Okay. We don't necessarily have to use that factor. The other thing is you can see that the maximum energy transfer depends on the mass of the wind. We can, we just don't have to use it. For us, it's an extra. Okay, we can see winds without having to look for... the way you use this factor is the Earth is going around the sun. Okay. We don't have to use the angle. So, we want to see it. But we don't have to use it. It's not necessary. Anyway, that's where it enters, effectively, through the maximum energy transfer. And, of course, maximum energy transfer depends on the mass. And as the mass of the wind goes to zero, you get the minus.
Okay. So
yeah.
All your analysis, so it covers the case of
the mass. You'll see. Yeah. Our sensitivity goes up. But then the left limit cuts in and says at least there's no funny new particle that the W or Z is decaying to.
I see. So the experiment covers or doesn't cover?
It does. Axion. Ours does not cover Axion. It definitely doesn't cover Axion. In fact, it's just our experiment by itself doesn't limit very light wimps. But then there are other things out there.
So you're always thinking of a massive,
that's
massive
right.
Compared to
that's right.
You.
Very much so. Very much so. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Question about the velocity.
Yes.
So this 200 kilometers a second.
Yeah.
That's basically our velocity around the center.
That's correct.
Assuming
yeah.
The wimps are at rest. But the wimps are in some, when they're moving around.
Well, that's the next. I've gotten your mind prepared for typical values. Well, the typical value, if you plug in I think I plugged in a 50 JeV wimp, and if you use iodine, the maximum energy transfer is about 9 kV. But now, in reality, it isn't as though we're at rest and the wimps are coming to us. What's really happening is there's a bath of wimps going in all directions. And still, we've done the right order of magnitude analysis to start to understand what's going on. There's really a spectrum of wimps with respect to us. And you've got to fold your cross-section with that spectrum. This is a really easy cross-section. This is just a box, a flat between zero and the maximum energy transfer. And then you fold that with the spectrum, and you can get expectation. Does that sort of address the point? Okay, but, of us in our galaxy, or our galaxy? With respect to what? There we go. I don't get that number.
So that's large compared to the dark matter.
Yeah. Finding the dark matter.
Oh, scary. It's scary.
Right. Exactly. It's gravitationally bound. I obviously have a centric view. It probably doesn't even speak English. Unlike Star Trek. Okay. So that's crudely some kinematics and sort of what you look for. Let me go more towards the experimental side. And the first thing, this is where my own flight of fancy took hold. You just can't do it. You just can't get the seat. Okay, is the first thing. You can get in a little tiny. And so how deep? Okay, and this is sort of a funny plot. Okay, now what's being plotted here? Depth is the horizontal axis. Okay, and these are all names of various mines we do experiments in. And I'll just point out, the deepest mine would be over here. Deepest mine that I could find, at least, the other night on the internet, was the East Rand mine in South Africa. That would be, we always convert the rock to meters of water equivalent, as we call, so we can get a standard panel on the horizontal axis. That mine, the deepest mine we have, is 0.06% of the Earth's radius into it. Okay. And then I got curious, the Mariana Trench is a little deeper, okay? You know, 0.2% of the Earth's radius. The deepest hole that's ever been drilled, a well in the Kola Peninsula of northern Russia, near Finland, I guess, got about 12 kilometers in. Because it's rock above it, you could get 30,000 meters water equivalent. But yeah, it's only a little deeper than the Marianas Trench. But the problem is, it's only 20 centimeters across. It doesn't help you do an experiment very well. Now, what's being plotted here on the horizontal axis is a different measure of depth, and that is the muon flux that survives from the cosmic ray interactions in the atmosphere, and that's in one. This is in a logarithm of 1 m² per second. So you know about 100 near the surface, and as you go deeper, this line tells you how your muons die off, and there's you know. Some sort of hadronic component, I guess, or you fold with the spectrum and you get this sort of decline. Now, our experiments so far have taken place in a tunnel under a street at the Stanford campus. It's a little bit, it's about, you know, about 30 meters of dirt. Okay. Not a very deep run. But there's a whole point to that, is that we had shops near us and we could develop technology while we were there. And it was sufficient for the results you're about to see. But clearly, we're limited in the end by neutron backgrounds, and our next step will be moving the experiment to the Sudan mine, one of the deeper ones in the United States, at least deeper ones that's kept with power and electricity and the water getting pumped out and stuff like that. And our backgrounds will decline by 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 orders of magnitude. And that's the point to going there. And we haven't done that yet, but that's our future plan. Dama is in the Grand Sasso. Dama is our Italian competitor, you might say. They're in the Grand Sasso mine in Italy, and there they are. Okay, they're substantially deeper, but as you'll see, at least in our technology, we're able to do quite well there, and there's really no need to go deeper yet. Okay. So the other thing about the Earth is when you go deep, oh yeah, when they got to the bottom of this hole, 180 degrees centigrade is the temperature. It gets hot as you go deep. And that's because the Earth is radioactive. Rutherford's famous founder took Kelvin or whoever said the Earth was only a few thousand years old. It has heat sources. Okay. But that same radioactivity that makes the Earth warm gives us background. Okay. And that ultimately is, you got to deal with that background somehow. And that's where. But by the way, Mark, it's interesting if you search on this thing, you can find that there are a number of religious groups. And they say there's something else going on to make it hot down there. You could buy something else, but they found a lot of noise down there, which some groups say is related to the screams of people in agony. It is. It's a wild web search to do. I don't know. I believe it's centigrade, but I may have screwed that up. It may be Fahrenheit. Now that I think about it, okay, I may have misread it, but it's hot. Okay, either way, it's pretty hot. It is much hotter than centigrade. Than okay, but the Earth is radioactive. At least, that's what I think. Or there's something more interesting than the traditional thing. Yeah, that's right. okay, so there's Dama, and they're only small a's because I didn't have an eraser. Okay, I meant, you know, that's the name, dark matter experiment. Okay, and the way they deal with radioactive background is they say, look, our signal has a modulation that the radioactive background does not have. And that's, you know, as well as doing their best to get rid of radioactivity, they say, after we've done everything we can, they do a lot of great stuff. Then they say, look, let's look for an annual modulation. Okay, and what that is the Earth's velocity modulating the relative velocity, which in turn modulates the maximum energy transfer. And it should be an annual modulation. Their signal to noise, that is the little ripple on top of the background, is a few percent. Okay. Well, that's I'll come to that. That's an interesting point. Okay. I forgot to write it here. The whole point of the CDMS endeavor is to get a signal to noise that's at least one and maybe large. That's what we're trying to do, to make it possible to reject the radioactive packet. Okay. And let me talk about Donner before going into what we do. Here's a picture of Donner. And what you see is they use sodium iodide. And iodine is the main thing that would recoil against the wind. Sodium iodide is a tremendously sensitive particle detector. Even though it was discovered long ago, it's still just incredible. Okay, the amount of, the way it works is that you deposit some energy, and the energy ultimately turns into light, and then you read it out with phototube. And the sensitivity of that process is just without parallel. It's just the best there is. Okay. Of course, you've got to use the most pure sodium iodide, radioisotopically pure, everything basically. And you can see to shield against the radioactivity, they have, I believe, a polyethylene shield. Polyethylene moderates neutrons and gets them to slow down, and they get captured with other stuff usually. Okay. And actually, there's some cadmium in here that is, I believe, I don't think you can see it, I think it's inside of the lens. Okay, and then the typical building material that we use is copper, by the way. When you need some metal, you don't use aluminum or steel, you use copper. Because copper can be electroformed, and in the electroforming process, it purifies a lot. So it's got almost no radioactivity. So just the generic frames and stuff you make out of it end up being copper. And then inside of that, that's copper, that's inside. And then in between the copper and the polyethylene, there's low background lead. The best lead you can get is lead that's been on a ship at the bottom of the ocean for a few hundred years in a shipwreck. Okay. Because what happens is its own internal radioactivity has died, and it has been kept out of the way of the cosmic rays, and so it doesn't get reactivated. And we do. I'm sure. I haven't checked for this. That's where we got it, from the shipwreck.
From the shipwreck.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, it's not cheap, and so the but it just has to look cheap. You know the Department of Energy. Okay. So that's their experiment. There's nothing surrounding this. If a muon comes through, there's no external device that tells them that it was a muon, but they have so many crystals that they say, look, a dark matter signal should only appear in one of the crystals. Anytime there's a signal in more than one, it's not dark matter, and then a muon's there. That's how that works. And let me see, is there anything left on? Okay. Oh, their exposure, they have a bunch of configurations of the experiment. This is their latest configuration. They keep upgrading, about 20,000 kilogram days. Oh, the total mass here is near 100 kilograms. This is much greater than we're able to get. Okay. And, their early runs, they didn't have as much mass, and they've been going up and on and so forth. But in the end, what you do is you say, okay, when only one crystal is struck, but there's light in both phototubes on either end, that tends to protect you against the phototube just having what we call a dark hole. Okay, you look for light in both ends. So something happened in the crystal and light went both directions. Okay. You just look at that. This is the kind of plot you get. This is gamma. And here's 0 to 10,000 electron volts. A typical for, a 50 or 100 JeV WIMP, the maximum energy transfer would be about 9, and then the sweet region is down here somewhere, and they use 2 to 6 KeV. And you can see on this axis, this is the number of counts per day, per kilogram, and then per KeV, because it's plotted versus the energy. Okay, so there's 10 KeV of width here on this plot. And you can see they've gotten to one count per day per kilogram per KV, which is quite good. Okay, but now this is not this plot by itself has scant evidence of a dark matter signal. What it has some evidence of, by the way, is the K edge, I believe, of sodium. Okay, that's what causes this bomb, which is an impressive thing to see, actually, an escape effect, I believe. Okay, and okay. Now what you want to do is take this data and plot it versus month of the year, if you like. Okay. And they do it just for the data in that energy function. So that's the next plot. it's the K edge of one of the materials.
Not the bump. Oh. Why they're selecting that?
Oh. Sorry. I just called it was the sweep region. That what's happening really is this is about the maximum energy transfer. There's a spectrum that results from the folding of the cross section with the spectrum of galactic WIMPs, and it rises. And they're saying this region is our sweet region, and down here we're running into cut that out. Above here there's not much signal, but there's a lot of background. So define a typical region. And well, I should keep that thought because then there are some of the questions that keep getting asked. Okay. So then they look at that then in plot versus time and days, wherever their experiment started. And I guess the big dashed intervals are at 1 year interval. Okay. And they look at this and fit and say, look, there is a sinusoid. Okay. You know, the only reason it doesn't look exactly like a sinusoid is statistical fluctuations is the argument. The period is determined by the Earth's going around the sun. The phase is determined somehow by astronomical observation. And these are just different configurations in the experiment where they change the hardware.
So why don't they curve the
same? I should have overplotted. I didn't bring with me their overplot of the sinusoid. Okay, they fit a sinusoid. The peak is roughly there. This is peak, roughly another peak. They fit a sinusoid. It goes through those, and you know, it's consistent with the phase that is expected by must be the proper motion of the sun. Yeah, exactly. That's right. Okay, and I'm not strong. I should know that in my head. I looked for it a bit before I gave this talk, but not hard.
That's just when you're facing to the center of the galaxy, this density is expected to have flux. When you're facing the other way.
No, it's got to be just in there. It is the phase you expect, yes. Now, they do various statistical tests where they say, okay, you know, they do a fit where they say, fix the period, fix the phase, what's the chi-squared, looks good. And then they say, let the phase float, but fix the period. Fix the phase and let the period float, and both those look good too. Okay. It's good.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. You've subtracted off a big zero here. This is again in counts per day per kilogram per kV. This is the ripple on top of this guy, where the scale was one. Okay, so this guy, when you plot it versus time, goes up and down by a order a couple percent, which is what you see there. Yeah, but then they all coherently line up just the right way. I can tell you, you know, from a pure experimental viewpoint, what I always would like to see in this situation, but I'll say why it doesn't necessarily bother me, is I'd sure like it if they take this data, 6 to 10, and go that far. Okay? You know, is dark matter everywhere in your experiment, or is this where it should be? and here too. You know, can you prove you cannot discover dark matter? And you ask that question, and they say, yes, we've done that, they look great. Okay? All right. And when I worked in the CERN CP violation experiment, we would be asked to plot, and the usual style there was to say, we looked at it, it looked fine, and expect that people believe you. And it turned out that in that case, it was they were to be believed. And I tried to change the response a little, but I never succeeded. It's just, you know, I don't want to show you all the grimy details, but are you going to trust me or not? Sort of, an honest guy. Okay. Now, I feel Americans are tempered to not believe that response, but that doesn't mean they're wrong at all. Okay. I really hope they're right. Okay. But that's my objections all center around those sort of questions. What is the stability, the calibration, all sorts of stuff like that. And I haven't seen the plot. That doesn't prove they're wrong, by the way. But that's where I feel a little bit uncertain. As well as the fact that it's a five, or it's a couple percent on a couple percent ripple on a couple percent. Okay. So what do we do then?
Why did it close on?
Oh, that's all. I think that that's an interesting question, and I think that's they vary their bidding actually. It's just the bin width, and it's variable bin.
Oh, it's not an error bar.
No, it's not an error bar. It's just the bin width, but they look out for variable bin. Width.
Okay.
But again, I went through it on Epsilon Prime. We were right in here. What's that? Yeah, they don't need to bend the data. I believe they do. I'll show you. Oh, well, this is consistent with the amplitude of this guy is related to the mass of the wimp because that tells you how the energy transfer how much energy transfer spills over into their fiducial region about 50 JeV. And the cross section, which gives you how often it happens, okay, so that also influences the modulation. About 7, 10 to the minus 42 centimeters squared. Okay, and I'll show you plots as with ours, overplotted and so forth. Okay, so what do we do? Yeah. Yeah. One could say, because there are things vary on annual cycles, right, like the temperature. And, convection. There's any number of things that have annual variation. These questions they've answered quite well. Okay, they really control their apparatus. It does not exchange gas with the environment around it. It's sealed off. Okay. They say they stabilize their electronics and all sorts of things. They've really done a lot of work to stabilize the experiment away from garden variety annual modulation. But the bin, I would like to just see the data in other bins. See you not see where it's in other bins. Is that answer the question? No. I feel like I didn't hit it. So.
I'm not sure how it's cool.
Yeah. Well, traditionally you look in side bands as one reason. If it is some background, it's pretty much the same background over here. Just look over there and see if that has the annual modulation. That's the tradition. But I haven't seen the plot, although I say it. I haven't checked on Physics Letters whether it's been published yet. I mean, it's going to be published. Okay? This came out in January.
So, question back here. Why didn't they respond to
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that was probably... Sorry. I should be careful. And again, I've mostly been in accelerator-based particle physics. Back here, I wasn't really working in the field. But they did... Everything up to here had already been published. And that was published maybe 1997 or so. And what happened in January of this year was the subsequent load was given. Okay. To deal with the fact that the Earth and maybe all the material you use in your experiment is radioactive, what we've done in CDMS is say, look, there's two kinds of backgrounds. One that really can be distinguished from, let's say, WIMPs for weakly reacting mass and particles. Okay? And that is anything from descended from a photon or electron, well, those guys mainly interact with atomic electrons. That's just what WIMPs didn't. Okay? And when you interact with atomic electrons, you tend to make a lot of ionization, because you're banging right on the electron. And then the electrons go in and bang on the other. Okay, so if you can not only measure ionization, which, by the way, in sodium iodide, light is more or less proportional to ionization. If you can respond to something else, then that would be great. The one thing that looks like, the one garden variety radiation that looks like WIMPs are neutrons. Okay? And they push right on nuclei. They don't see electrons very much. Okay? And some generic comments just to prepare your mind. There are differences between neutrons and WIMPs. One is the lack of coherence. They don't coherently interact. Okay, so actually in our detectors, we use some silicon and some germanium, so if we start seeing a signal, we can distinguish. Okay. For neutrons, we also build a real good shield. Before I start talking about our detectors and WIMPs, I'll show you why I said that now. Here's the new shield for the new experiment that we just built at UCSB. Okay, and this is polyethylene. It's like cutting board material. If you buy white cutting boards, that's what it's at. And so this is all to stop neutrons. This is lead from a particular mine in the United States that has low background, low radioactive background. And this lead in here is from the shipwreck. Okay. And then there's also some polyethylene in there, and it's a long story as to why it's there. But ultimately, the actual WIMP detectors go in this shiny cylinder in the center. And you can see the hammer there. We actually already finished that. There he is. There's when we finished it, and really he finished it. I didn't do much. Okay. And Dave Hale and our crew, Dan Callahan. Okay, that's before it was shipped, and there it is in boxes up in Minnesota right now. That was probably a month ago. Is when this picture was taken. Okay, so this is the mine top of where we're going for the subsequent experiment. Well, you can shield against a lot of stuff, but in the end, you can't shield against everything. And that's when you want to be able to distinguish, first of all, these guys. You can never really distinguish from neutrons, but you have other handles on them and you can shield against them. But neutrons and WIMPs will deposit a relatively larger fraction of their energy into sound than will garden variety, than ionizing background material. Okay? And if you wait for that sound to thermalize, that's what we did in the first incarnation that we've been reporting on lately. So you wait, you know, the sound happens, you wait some number of milliseconds and actually measure the temperature change in your block of material. That's what we call CDMS1, and that we did at Stanford. And then what we'll do in the final experiment is directly detect the sound with sensors that are like phototubes, but for sound. You know, phonotubes, if you like, but there's no tube. phono detectors, okay? And at this point, I had a comment about the other most interesting technology, but I won't come back to that if you want.
The implications of the Italians cannot distinguish the WIMPs.
They might statistically be able to. The shape of the light in their phototube as a function of time for a WIMP would look a little different than the shape of these backgrounds. Okay, so the pulse shape, you would say. Okay, but when your signal background is, you know, 1 in 30 or so, it gets pretty hard to use that technique to differentiate the two things. If you had a better signal to background, you might be able to use that to decipher if they don't know. So in some sense, some people say they've not conclusively shown that their signal is WIMP. They've just shown they have angle modulation. Because they haven't shown with pulse shape discrimination that they're actually WIMP. Just hours. It's an interesting question. I don't think so. Okay, but you know, they're magnetic. You know, the neutrons come from cosmic rays initially, and I don't want to hazard a guess whether the local magnetic field that steer the cosmic rays might have some kind of effect. Okay, so let's talk about CDMS again. Oh, this is great. Yeah. okay. I think the third thing that I'm most there are a lot of ideas out there. There are a lot of flower clothing right now. Okay, or there have been for 10 years, right? Okay. But I like a lot of us really like the slow-mo bubble chamber, which is basically a gel. Okay. And without explaining how it works, it's a gel that's used in the nuclear power industry to detect neutrons. Okay. And so it would work for dark matter. And what happens is, you know, you carry like a test tube filled with a gel, you go into the reactor. If you get hit with some neutrons, a bunch of bubbles slowly grow. You take it back to your desk and you see a bunch of bubbles have grown, and you count the number of bubbles and you can see what your neutron dose was. And it's a bubble chamber, but it's in slow motion. It lasts for days. Okay? And it works. Okay. It responds to the amount of energy deposited per unit distance. Neutrons put a lot of energy in a little distance, as do dark matter. Okay, and that's the secret of how it works. So CDMS1, where we look for heat, it's at Stanford. It's under Panama Street. 30 feet, there's a tunnel next to the big end station at the High Energy Physics Lab. There it is, you blow that up. And there's a person size, a different shield. This time there's lead and then polyethylene and then cryogenics to cool down near absolute zero and the detectors. Yeah, we work near absolute zero. That was from the way beginning that I already said. Okay. And so what do the detectors look like? The ones we've been using, which respond to the thermalized phonon, there they are. And there's a side view, but you know, the size here, I don't know if there's something that you can see the size, but you know, about that far across in real size. Okay? And that is one of the detectors. There's a few more. For electrical isolation and so forth, they're in copper enclosures. Inside the copper, there's actually germanium that's also protecting, shielding for you. And actually, these are all made of germanium, all these ones that are shown. Okay. And so here's what's going on. Okay. You take your block of germanium, you put a voltage across it, so there's an electric field that takes ionization to, I guess we take electrons that way, and the electrode is divided into two pieces. That doesn't matter very much. You read out a charge signal like a normal detector, but on the other side, you have thermistors that convert temperature to voltage. And because you cooled within about a hundredth of a degree of absolute zero, the heat capacity is very advantageous. A little bit of energy deposited gives you a great increase in temperature. That's the key point. So these guys, neutron transmutation doped thermistors, give you a signal that then you can read out and see the evidence of sound, okay, getting thermalized. The one thing about this process is it takes a long time. All your ionization is done in some number of microseconds. To get this heat takes some number of milliseconds. And that's what that's the experimental problem, and that's one of the main things that worked on the new detectors to get rid of. Okay, so for the experiment where we're reporting on results, the actual configuration were four of these things on top of each other, nothing in between them. And so that's going to be important that there's nothing in between them. And in the end, after all sort of cutting out of data where things were screwed up, about 10 kilogram days. That should be compared with 50,000 kilogram days of the Italian experiment. Anyway, similar sensitivities. And how does that work? Well, the key is going to be comparing the energy deposited into heat in this case with that deposited into ionization. And so this is data. This isn't simulation. Calibration data. And what's being plotted here as a function of the amount of energy that was deposited and measured with heat, calibrated in kiloelectron volts, you then compare how much of the energy you got in ionization. So you divide the ionization energy by the amount that you saw in heat. Okay? And you set the scale so that generic backgrounds, electrons and photons are normalized to 1. Okay. And then you can see the way it works is if you shine neutrons, which are just like WNTs, if we get a source of neutrons and shine it on, you can see they make a lot more recoil energy for a given amount of ionization, or if you like, less ionization for a given amount of recoil energy. So you can distinguish these radioactive backgrounds from a WNT type thing. That's the heart of how these detectors work, being able to make this plot. And there's a really clean separation. The amount of leakage of this stuff into the nuclear recoil region is 0.1% to 0.5%, depending on the detector at the time. You can also see the scale, by the way, 20. This is actually our threshold, okay, where we trigger. We get down to some fraction of a kilovolt possible, okay, to take data. In the end, we make a further cut when we analyze the data. Okay, so this is calibration data. What we then do is we ran with these four detectors for about 45 days and added up 10 kilogram days. We're not that deep. If a cosmic ray muon went through, we have an external detector array that tells us. So we veto all that kind of stuff. And then make the equivalent plot like this, and there are four detectors. And here's what you see for the four detectors. Okay. These big bands are from external radioactivity. Okay. This green line guides your eye as to where either WIMPs or neutrons would appear. And you can see that this one detector, the one at the edge, has a lot of contamination. This was actively traced to be contamination that was introduced on the detector when it was made. So this has been deleted from our data. There are good reasons. It's not just because we don't like it. Okay. All right. And then, okay, so these three detectors are ones whose contamination record is clean. You can see that there is some actual added tendency for there to be events that don't have exactly one as their ratio of ionization to sound. We know what these events are. It's contamination that's on the surface of the detector, it turns out. Okay, this is the one that got really bad. Still, the dominant thing that dribbles background down into the WIMP region is contamination on the surface still. Okay. But you can see there are events there. And you put those all together, okay, and there you go. So this is combining those three detectors, and you count up the number of events in our signal region, which is between the dotted lines, and then we set a threshold. Our ability to discriminate gets worse as you go to low energy, so about 10 keV is where we start accepting candidates for being WIMPs. There's 13 events in that region. Okay. And you can convert, it's about one event per kilogram per day. That's in the region of the signal that the Dom experiment is seeing. And to take that now, make this key plot. So here's a plot of WIMP mass versus interaction cross-section. The Dahmer region, again, is around 50 in mass, about 8 × 10⁻²² in cross-section. Okay? And that's, they have this sort of heart-shaped region there. That's the Dahmer allowed region. And no cross-section is disallowed at the 3-sigma confidence level by their data. Okay? 3-sigma is that confidence. But this other stuff has to do with Suzy models. Get to it later. If you take, for example, that spot in the region and come over and plot the spectrum that we would expect as a function of recoil energy, okay, with the cross-section that you expect, you'd expect this blue curve. And our data is green. Okay. If you go down to the lowest end and plot the same thing, it looks like it's not so inconsistent with our data. So the question is, are these WIMPs or are these neutrons? Okay. And because we can't distinguish neutrons from WIMPs, we knew we'd have neutron background because we're so close to the surface. The best way to solve this problem is to go deep and just get rid of the neutrons. Okay. But now we have to make an estimate of... they are deep. That's right. It's coincidence. It's just our surface. Well, see, either it's the dark matter or it's a coincidence. Okay? Their dominant background is actually photons and electrons. And their little wiggle on top of it, who knows? Maybe it's dark enough. Our dominant background is neutrons, because we're able to throw away the photons and electrons. We still have neutrons. We developed our technology at the surface. Okay. With a much smaller detector. Okay, so the thing is, there's a way to decide whether it's neutrons or WIMPs. Okay. Neutrons have such a whopping cross-section that they'll not just interact once, but they'll interact twice. And after all, a strong interaction cross-section, not a weak interaction. WIMPs will only ever interact once, never twice. So this enables you a tool to see, or this gives you a cross-check to see, are you seeing WIMPs or are you seeing neutrons? And so multiple interactions. You Monte Carlo, all the geometry, that's another, the old tradition. And this is just a favorable. But then we do a whole Monte Carlo. How often should we see?
I didn't understand why it was so
difficult. Let me show you the shield we have. But they can high energy neutrons can penetrate. It turns out low energy neutrons you can moderate. But again, when you get up to high energy, there's a punch through probability. you can only buy a tunnel so big, and you know, that in the end, practical constraints make it impossible to totally shield out neutrons. Well, the best way, the cheapest way to shield out neutrons is to go deep in ground, not to build more shielding at the surface. Okay, so what we do is plot all pairs of detectors that fired and plot their relative amount of ionization of the first detector, call it 4 or 5, okay, along this axis. And again, one is where radioactive background or gamma is an electron bar, okay, and low is where neutrons are. And then take the other detector, 5 or 6, and plot its signal for double signals along the vertical. And what you see is there are 3 neutron events. Okay. You should never see this number of events if you had WIMP. And a bunch of electrons in both. And similarly, these are the ones that have a detector between them. Okay, so this is 4 versus 6. The other pair of guys. Okay, there's one neutron and a bunch of photons. This plot tells us we've got neutrons. Not WIMPs. And it's now a matter of estimating exactly how to do the background subtraction. Go through. I have a diagram of how neutrons come. You might think, by the way, there's one other bit of information in that plot. That is the energy spectrum more consistent with being neutrons or more consistent with being WIMPs, like Dhamma has? It's got a bit of a high tail. That's a bit what neutrons would do, but it's not totally conclusive. Okay. Yes. No, this is no subtraction. That's our actual data. That's our actual data. And these are just WIMP predictions overlaid on top of it. Yeah. 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 We're able to make a subtraction now. Am I answering your question? Yeah. And that's what we do. Well, that's what I'll show. I haven't plotted any CDMS curves on this yet. This is just Dhamma. And now I'll plot the CDMS curve that we determined by doing a background subtraction. And, you know, this ultimately tells you what we're subtracting. And these are various different Monte Carlo systems. The blue and the this is a function of recoil energy, our data, and 2 different Monte Carlo assumptions for what neutron spectrum would look like. Looks like it's neutrons. Do a subtraction, and here you go. Okay. So what's being plotted again here is WIMP mass versus interaction cross-section. After you do the neutron background subtraction, this blue curve is the boundary of allowed region, excluded region. Okay, at 90% confidence level. Okay, of our result at the surface at our shallow site at Stanford. Okay. And you can see, this was our old result from earlier data, about a year and a half ago. Okay. And you can see most of this region is inconsistent. Okay. Yeah, of course, yeah. Okay. Yeah. But, you know.
But you're not running
That's correct. You can, their 3 sigma region is inconsistent with us or we ruled out at the 84% confidence level, okay? Their 2 sigma region, which is this green smaller region, we rule out at the 96% confidence. And there are various other statistical comments you could make, but that's the case, basically. Okay? That's the curve that I think you want to see. So now, what next? We're going to a deep site. Where are we going to get to, or what are we going to do, and where are we going to get to? Totally different detectors. This is what they look like. Okay. Our prototypes have been made of silicon, although now we have them functioning on germanium, which is good because of the cross section, and it's the same sort of geometry, hockey puck, but different essentially pickups on the surface. Okay. So this is actually a matrix of many, many small detectors. Each one of them, in the end, is a superconducting tungsten, where the Cooper pairs actually get I'll say ionized. Why not? That must be right. Ionized. Okay. Superpairs are actually busted up by phonons bumping into them. So phonons made in the crystal go up and in the superconductor on their surface bust up Cooper pairs. And a lot of the magic then comes in collecting those Cooper pairs into a current and then reading them out in the switch. That's the basic way they work. Now, the first thing you win due to this is much faster response. There was once a hope of some directionality. Turns out the way phonons propagate, you lose directionality, so we don't really get directionality out of it. Okay. And these are called zips. One great thing you get from this is the time between the ionization and when the phonons get to the phonon collectors enables you to determine where in the crystal the interaction occurs. And if all the WIMPs seem to occur at the edges, you know you have garbage. WIMPs should occur uniformly throughout the whole crystal. So that's some of the things you get out of this. Where will we think we'll get to in the end? When we go deep and have our full mass deployed, first of all, our backgrounds, we think, go down by at least a factor of 100, maybe a factor of 1,000. Mainly based on running time and mass that we're able to build, we think after several years at Sudan, okay, our limit will go from where it is now, several 10 to the minus 42, down to 10 to the minus 44 or so, about two orders of magnitude. That's with the technology that's working, the new detectors that we have working, and we're approved to just start building as fast as we can. I should say, Tony, you asked a question. At low masses, we don't deposit energy, so our limit trails off. At high masses, there ain't that many WIMPs to make up the missing mass, and so your limit again goes up. Okay. That's crudely how this thing works. Presumably left wing. Okay. Particularly if it's weakly interacting. If that's leading to weak interaction, what should I have seen it? Oh yeah, what are all these other things? These dots and greenish region, purplish, magenta region are all various favored parameter spaces of supersymmetry models. Okay. And so we're gradually eating into the heart of supersymmetry in some sense. We think this thing will be online the time at which we're calling first dark. next spring. Thank you very much. Directionality? That's an interesting question. With us, I can tell you, as a very practical matter, we have a blackboard, don't we? Okay. The thing is, the little bit of condensed matter physics I've learned is that here's your crystal, okay, and here's a nucleus that takes off with a recoil. And you'd like to get the direction of that recoil if you could. And somehow you look at that and you say, it's got to be the phonons remember which direction it started to go. Okay? And so a phonon comes out, and I don't even know how to draw a phonon. I'll draw it like a gluon. Okay? So it comes out. And the thing is, most of the phonons we create that are, until they stop propagating, scatter very quickly. And they scatter again. And actually, when they scatter, it's worse. You actually tend to make multiple phonons. From the first high-energy phonon you get, you tend to make two downshifted phonons. And they tend to forget the direction of the initial one. Okay. And then what happens is the lower energy you get, this interaction, the high-energy guys essentially Rayleigh scatter. In my mind, they Rayleigh scatter. They bounce around. Except for this thing, the mean free path is very short, and then when they try to Rayleigh scatter, they really down-convert. And it turns out that these guys actually have a longer mean free path and go further. And that when you get sufficiently low energy that you don't Rayleigh scatter anymore, that's called ballistic. Okay? And so the ballistic phonons are the ones that propagate a large distance and remember their direction. And it turns out most of the phonons we collect in the end are descended from a high energy one, and in the interaction that created the low energy one, we forgot the direction. Okay. So that's the problem. Now, nevertheless, when we read this guy out, okay, we've taken great pains in the data acquisition system, at least in the planning of it, to preserve all the timing information we can. Okay, so, you know, we think that if we record the times of all the signals we can, we might somehow, you know, by building a neural net or something, be able to reconstruct the direction. Okay, so I guess my best answer is intrinsic in the experiment, we've done our best to build up as much capability or capacity as we can to do future analyses to try to get directionality out. That other experiments? Yeah, well, I can say one thing that you know, this is my own bias. You could say don't use a condensed matter, use a gas. And then the direction of the recoil, you know, the recoil nucleus will go a lot further in the gas. My own gut tells me at square zero, long before I start thinking about it, how do you get the mass if you use a gas? How do you get enough mass in an experiment? Because gases are 1,000 times less dense than condensed matter. You need a giant experiment. And then for the giant experiment, it just gets so hard to maintain low-level activities and stuff in a room size experiment. I'm pessimistic about that. Other approaches I'm probably ignorant about. Yet other approaches. Those are the ones that I'm familiar with. Yeah. Yes, terrific. I actually wasn't in the room yet. I got there a little late, unfortunately. In any case, there's a mystery with phototubes. And the usual way you argue that you shouldn't be concerned with this, I mean, the comment that shocked us all, I'm looking for my transparency of the Gamma experiment. There we go. I guess the thing that was shocking about the Boolby result, Neil Spooner, was that it's known the pulse shape that could look like a recoil neutron can be faked by a dark pulse in one phototube. That is, if somehow, like, there's radioactivity in the phototube itself, it can initiate a pulse that you can see. Okay. But normally, you say those things aren't going to cause a dark matter signal, those dark pulses, because the other phototube won't see them. Because if it's a dark pulse that is in phototube A, phototube B shouldn't know about that. But it appears, for example, that this class of pulses that he's talking about, which he thinks are dark pulses, actually may emit some light by some mechanism in phototube A, emit some light that then initiates something in phototube B. And what mechanism it is for a so-called dark pulse to actually emit a little light and be picked up by the other guy, no one knows right now. He's quite convinced. I guess the experiment is very simple. If you remove the sodium iodide and you still see the pulses, which is, I take it, what's happened, okay, then you know it's not dark matter. And I'm pretty sure that's Ray, is that, you heard the test. Okay, but that's the key test. Phototubes themselves can generate pulses, but what none of our minds were prepared for was that they could generate a little light, too, and the other phototube could see them generate a pulse. Traditionally, we say dark matter should make coincidences, and dark pulses should not, but it appears that dark pulses are capable of it.
Well, that's a problem for everything.
It is a problem for everything.
Which is called
That's right. And I think he and others feel that maybe Gamma hasn't properly addressed this. Okay. Okay. My pleasure.